I mean, being around somebody who's dying or even being in the conversation and contemplation of mortality can shift you. You know, it shifted me in a major way. And I think that that is a gift, to be able to get that close to death in some capacity and see what it has to teach me about my own life.
Hi, and welcome to the All Too Well podcast. I'm your host, Erica Huss. I'm a wellness expert, an entrepreneur, and your wellness whisperer, here to make your journey towards better health just a little more comfortable and a little less cringy. And I'm very excited to share this very special conversation today. I chatted with Alua Arthur, who is a death doula, and she's probably the preeminent death doula of our times at this point. She has worked for many years with families and people themselves who are facing end-of-life scenarios to really come to terms with what they're facing ahead and how they've lived their lives. And her story, her personal story in terms of how she actually arrived there, is just so incredibly powerful. She's a speaker. She's an author. She's coming out with a new book. She's just come out with a new book called Briefly Perfectly Human, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End. And her TED Talk, which is entitled Why Thinking About Death Helps You Live a Better Life, is something that you absolutely should check out after you listen to this interview. I don't think I will need to encourage you to do so, because I think you'll be so compelled by everything she has to share. I was, you know, I'll be the first to admit, I was a little nervous going into this conversation, because as many of us, we don't really know how to talk about death in our culture and end of life scenarios. And it was actually an incredibly vibrant, incredibly upbeat and funny and warm conversation that I had with Alua, and I adore her. I think that you will come to love her within the first 5 seconds of listening as well. So without further delay, please enjoy my chat with Alua Arthur. Let's kick it off. Alua Arthur, welcome. I'm so happy to meet you and be able to have this conversation and hear all of these incredible projects that you're working on and what you're doing in your very, very special field. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Erica. It's really a pleasure.
So you're about to publish a book called Briefly Perfectly Human, which I had a chance to read, and it absolutely blew me away. And backtracking from the book, the reason that you decided to write it was because of the story that you have lived and the life, the work that you do as a death doula. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And you have an incredible TED Talk as well. So yeah, can you just share with listeners what you are doing, what you do, and how you arrived at this moment? Because the story is so incredibly powerful.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a death doula, who is somebody who does all of the non-medical care and support of the dying person and the circle of support through the process. Although it looks like also working with healthy people who have some awareness that one day death will come. I got into this field after a decade practicing law at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles, where I grew really, really, really depressed. The work, theoretically, was the type that should fill your soul. You know, we were paid pennies on the dollar compared to what my counterparts in law school made working in corporate firms to do work that was noble and just. And yet it ate away at my spirit. Not only were the people that were involved in the system not getting any further, their situations weren't advancing in any way, it also felt like the systems were designed to help keep them where they were, and there was no way for them to get out of it. And I was angry, and I was sad, and I was frustrated, and I felt like I wasn't making any change. This depression grew really, I mean, really deep. It planted roots in my body and in my psyche. And I took a medical leave of absence from work, where I went to Cuba, and I met a fellow traveler on a bus who had uterine cancer. And we talked a lot about her life. And then I started asking her questions about her death, and she answered them, surprisingly. And we really journeyed together. We were on the bus together for 14 hours, but we also journeyed through our hopes and our regrets and our fears and her illness and what she still wanted to do with her life and who she saw on her deathbed. And being in that conversation with her allowed me to start thinking about my own life And if my disease of depression killed me, which depression can be a life-limiting illness when it's left untreated, if my disease of depression killed me, was I pleased with the life that I had lived so far? Like, was I okay with it? And the answer was no, at all. And so using my mortality as a lens, I kept looking at my life, and I've been doing so ever since, and I'm really inviting other people to do the same. After I came back from Cuba, 6 months later, my brother-in-law, Peter St. John, became ill. And I got to go to New York, where he and my sister and my niece were for the last 2 months of his life, when the doctors had said that they couldn't treat him anymore. It was such a dense time. There was so many errands to run. There was so much stuff to do. There was a lot of like busy work, even with all the sickness. Then there was also the big emotional toll, all the grief and the sadness and the fear and the hope and the crushing defeat, especially when he died. But being present for his death was the greatest gift I've ever been given. It allowed me to see all of these ideas that I'd had theoretically in Cuba about how we leave people alone in their dance with mortality. It allowed me to see it in real time, and also connect to this very, very real human experience we'll all have at some point, which is our dying and the lack of support that existed. And I was like, nah, I'm not with this. I want us to do better for each other, and we can do better for each other. And so I thought of all the things that I needed, and then came back and made a role for myself. 10 years later, here we are, talking to you about this, writing a book
Amazing.
About it.
Amazing. Yeah, writing a book about it. And you also have an organization dedicated to it, is Going With Grace. Can you talk a little bit about that, like how it operates within your sphere?
Sure. Going With Grace is an end-of-life planning and training and support organization. We exist to support people as they answer the question for themselves, what must I do to be at peace with myself so that I may live presently and die gracefully? So both those things. So no matter what the answer is for the individual, we can support with. Sometimes it's practical, like getting their affairs in order, legal in that capacity, although we don't do any legal work. We just work with a great team of estate planning attorneys to answer questions. Some of it is emotional and relational, and some of it is spiritual as people are thinking through their ideas about the afterlife. So whatever it is that folks need, also encompassing healthy people as they are writing comprehensive end-of-life plans, or people that know what it is that they're going to be dying of, we can support. Mm-hmm. We also train death doulas. We've trained about 2,500 now in 17 countries. I know. It's
incredible.
So fun. It's so cool.
It's amazing.
So rad.
I would like to understand a bit more about what's involved with that. But I'm just curious, going back to the story that you shared in Cuba, when you were on the bus, when you met this woman, what was it, do you think, that made you even ask her, like, how do you feel about your death? Because I know that, I mean, that's not a question that I think I would necessarily ask of somebody who I met in that. I mean, I know you had 14 hours on the bus, so you got to fill up the time somehow. But I think you speak to this very specifically and frequently, that, you know, as a culture, we are very afraid of death. We are very afraid of illness. We freeze up, we kind of pull away, because we don't know how to deal with it. So what was it in you that made you ask that question?
I'm still curious about that myself.
Yeah.
On the one hand, I was still a little drunk from the night before, honestly. I'd only slept a couple of hours. On another hand, I generally have a hard time with tact. I don't know what is the appropriate thing to say at the appropriate time. I'm always the weirdo in the corner saying, spitting out the one thing that's on her mind when everybody else is talking about flowers or something.
Well, that's how you get shit done. I'm sorry. That's actually how things move forward, is being direct.
And I also don't really know how to like couch in subtlety. It's never been my strong suit. I don't think any part of me is subtle. And for the reality of it all, it was the first time I'd been confronted with it. And that curiosity bubbled up in me and came out my mouth before I could stop it, which was like, wait, what? You have what? And you're thinking about what? Like, It knocked me over, and I couldn't help it. And I said it, and I did immediately question whether or not I should have, but she came along with me and we started talking. So it worked out pretty well for both of us, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm sure. And so then when you were present for Peter and for his family and through that process, I mean, at that point for you, was it more guided by instinct, or did you have resources that you were referring to? I mean, this is not a field that I think a lot of people are aware even exists, let alone, you know, however long ago that was. That was 15 years ago?
10 years ago.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
So what were your, like, how did you navigate that process for yourself?
Instinct.
Yeah.
And what the needs were, you know, it was like every day, just wake up and see where we at, what is necessary. How are his kidneys doing today? How are her spirits? What does my sister need? What does my niece need? His parents are flying into town, pick them up, handle things at the house back, like just instinct, just moving on sheer. Let me do everything I can so that they don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, because they had a lot to worry about. Granted, I was also losing my brother-in-law.
Right.
Yeah. But I felt the needs of my sister and my niece and his parents were greater. I was just one ring in the layer, in the rings of support around him as he was dying.
And I think that, I mean, I'm going to venture to guess that most of the people in this field are women. Is that correct?
That's accurate.
Yeah. I feel like we just innately have this in our DNA to, like, we have to power through these incredibly uncomfortable, you know, terrible, stressful, traumatic, awful experiences. Something in us instinctually, not all of us, I mean, granted, that's why there are people like you, but it's in the people like you and this field that you just kick into this other gear where you know that you have to get the stuff done. And you know that most likely in this situation, you're the only one who's going to be able to get it done. So you have to tap into that. So, I mean, it's not about finding silver linings in very, very, very terrible clouds, but obviously that opportunity, that moment really presented an opportunity for you to kind of find meaning in something that felt very meaningless.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also I think by virtue of my personality, and this is a similar trait I find in many that come to the work, is we're givers. We're highly empathic. Mm-hmm. But on some level, it can be detrimental too, because when somebody's dying, the needs are so great. And so it's like, we'll just give and give and give and give and give. And one thing that I had to learn how to do, not during that time, but later on in my practice, was to create some boundaries so that I could stay well, to be able to continue giving. During that time, I was barely sleeping. I was running all day long. I take cat naps here and there. Maybe a friend would meet for a coffee or lunch, but it was, you know, I was so, I don't even know the word. It just feels like electricity going through my blood all the time. Things need to get done. Somebody had to do them.
You talk about that in the book, that concept of empathy being, I mean, it's an incredibly wonderful gift for those of us who have it, but it also comes with a burden, right? Because it can be, you say it can become addictive, and there's some level of reward. It's like pleasure seeking, and that, I mean, it's not pleasure seeking, but you know what I mean? Like seeking and reward to sort of check that box or ding that bell. So how do you, as an empathic person, how do you navigate that in the work that you do? Like, how do you, I imagine that is a great part of the training, is understanding how to draw that boundary. But can you talk a little bit about that concept of it becoming addictive? Because I think there are quite a lot of people, I mean, I feel myself, I'm like a bleeding heart. The story in the book about the goat, like I couldn't actually even read the story because I found it so upsetting. And that's, you know, however many degrees away. So I totally felt that moment for you.
Yeah. And I was 12. I was crushed, absolutely crushed. It felt like it hit me or a family member. And so I'm porous in a way, and I have been for so long. It can be addicting because I think it feeds that part of me that says that I'm needed and I'm wanted. Mm-hmm. And I translate that to mean that I'm loved or I'm worthy somehow. So a lot of my work, while recognizing that, has been to figure out the place from which I'm giving. Am I giving in order to get? Am I giving in order to feel worthy and to feel loved? Or am I giving just for the sake of giving because these folks really need it and I have the capacity to do so? Am I giving from like a pure place or to fix it, feel something inside of me? I also have been noticing a lot that it's really necessary for us to do this work from the place of compassion rather than from the place of empathy. One of the core components of the course is that we train doulas to think about the work through their own lives, to think about their personal relationship with death. One thing that is a determining factor in how effective a death doula is how well they've built up their own personal relationship with death. It does not mean that they cannot fear death in any way. It just means that they are familiar with them, that they can name them, they're comfortable with them. Because if not, I will collapse the space between myself and the person that I'm serving, clouding it all with my ideas, my thoughts, my fears, what I think I would need in that circumstance, rather than showing up to support them and theirs. Empathy says, I know what you're feeling, or I know what your experience is. When the goat was killed, it killed me. It mm-hmm. killed somebody I loved, mm-hmm. yet it was a goat. I have no idea what that goat's experience was.
Maybe it was an asshole.
Maybe it was a little asshole goat. Little motherfucker.
Sorry.
That was perfect. Thank you. It was great. Maybe it was a little dick. But the reality is that maybe what I thought was fear and that goat wasn't fear, you know?
Yeah.
But I heaped all this meaning on it from my perspective, which is not fair. We can't do that to humans when they're dying. Right. We can't. Yeah. Right. We got to let them have their experience.
I mean, I imagine that a good portion of the experience and in the work, in the process that you're in, has to do with empowering people to have some sense of control or at least understanding of a situation that is very, very difficult to control and understand. And that, I think, goes for the person themselves who is facing their end of life, as well as their family members. I mean, is it a collaborative process in that way for you? Or, I mean, I know I imagine it varies case by case as well, but.
It's entirely collaborative.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're there for the entire circle of support. Sometimes the person who's hiring me is not the dying person. Sometimes it's a family member. Sometimes the dying person doesn't yet have an awareness that their death is approaching, or at least does not want to acknowledge it, which mm-hmm. means that I'm not working with them directly. I mean, because it's kind of like written into the deal. You know what I mean? I'm a death doula, you're dying. But if they're not there, then right. I'm not working with them directly. Maybe it's a family member that wants some support or feedback about how to work with their family member, or they need to figure out how to stay present. Anticipatory grief has clouded everything for them, and mm-hmm. they want to work through that, or they need a checklist on how to plan for the end of life or something of the sort. So sometimes mm-hmm. I'm just working with one of the people who's supporting the dying person too.
Mm-hmm. And what about in cases of an unexpected death, whether that is somebody dies by suicide, somebody is tragically killed in an accident, whatever it is, I imagine that process is very different. Or, I mean, how does that work? Because obviously in that case, you're only dealing with the family and the loved ones and not the person themselves. But is that process more challenging or just a different set of challenges?
A different set of challenges.
Yeah.
Certainly when there's a suicide, there's all the, a lot of shame and confusion about what happened and why. And often folks are trying to get out of the cloud of, confusion and sorrow mixed with grief. But what we can do in the case of sudden or unexpected deaths is support family members in working through their experience of what happened. There's a technique called reprocessing, I think, where folks just talk through the events of the day when they learned what had happened, where they were, what they were experiencing, maybe who found them, et cetera. And that process of reprocessing is really supportive in some ways, just to have somebody to talk it through and just to keep touching on that thing until they can make some sense or get some perspective from it. But we can help family members or folks in the circle of support plan for funerals, wrap up their affairs, figure out what direction to take from here, write obituaries, mm-hmm. the whole gamut, the things that mm-hmm. we would do when the death has occurred, when they knew it was coming, are the mm-hmm. same things that we can offer. And it's a great big push for folks, often after a sudden death, for them to start doing their own end-of-life planning right. so that when their time comes, they have done some preparation.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that, again, it's not about finding silver linings, but I have to imagine that just going through a process like this with you as a family member or a loved one of somebody who has passed is in itself an opportunity for them to look, just like what happened to you, kind of look at their own lives and take stock and say, okay, well, now that I've watched this whole process unfold, what can I do differently so that I feel like I'm leaving with, with grace or with a sense of actual fulfillment? And I mean, I imagine that for most people, I would hope that it triggers something for people to kind of renew themselves and their sense of their own life.
I think it does for many. And I also just want to name this phenomenon that happens where when somebody has died suddenly, often it triggers a big fear of death in other people that mm-hmm. were around and love them. And so it's a very normal experience. And one thing that I do then to support folks is help them start doing their planning to, as you were mentioning earlier, control what they can for now anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it does. I mean, being around somebody who's dying or even being in the conversation and contemplation of mortality can shift you. You know, it shifted me in a major way.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a gift to be able to get that close to death in some capacity and see what it has to teach me about my own life. It's one of the gifts that we can take from it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I actually can't imagine because I'm one of those people who I think, first of all, I'm fortunate enough to have not lost anybody very, very close to me at this stage in my life. But that's also, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing because I feel ill-equipped. I feel a little scared and nervous at the prospect of losing somebody or facing sickness and illness. I mean, so you said you've trained people from all over the world. You've also, I mean, you have your background, your family is from Ghana. What do you see as what is kind of uniquely this American, is it a uniquely American problem, issue, fear? Is it a Western thing versus like, what do you observe in like the huge spectrum of experience that you've had and also seen in others?
I would say that it is a uniquely Western approach to death and dying is to shun it and pretend it's not happening for a number of
that.
Reasons.
Yeah.
It's so wild to me because it's the only fact of our lives is that we're going to die. I think that what happens in the Western world is not only with the Industrial Revolution and also the move toward the nuclear family, apart from intergenerational living, is what we did is we've pushed the experience of elderhood into the corners, mm-hmm. into the background. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really see much of it. I live in Los Angeles. The other day I was driving down the street. I saw somebody who was, I guess, 87 or so, walking by herself. She was such a rare sight. I have not seen somebody that old out in LA in a long time, okay? Yeah, it was like she was a dragon walking on the street. Like, it should not be so rare.
Yeah.
In other places in the world, folks are still living with their elders. They're watching dying occurring at home. Folks are often dying at home. They're not heading off to hospitals at the drop of a dime in order mm-hmm. to see what type of life-saving measures, and I'm using air quotes around life-saving,
yeah.
what type of life-saving efforts can be made to extend this life that's going to be ending anyway. On top of that, I think we also have a real obsession with youth in the West, where yeah. we try to shun aging and elderhood and death and dying by filling our face with toxins and using all this cream to hide our wrinkles and dyeing our hair. And I'm not going to say that that doesn't exist in other cultures around the world, but I think we have a particular focus on youth here. Yeah. We push away anything that suggests that we are fallible or we are actually human, because being human means one day we'll die.
Yeah, I think that's 100% accurate. And it's a sad fact. I kind of was hoping that maybe you would say it's not uniquely American, that this is just what, you know, not uniquely Western, this is just how we are as humans, but we're not. I mean, cultures in the East have created rituals and ceremonies and celebrations of end of life. Some of it has to do with religious beliefs of the afterlife. And obviously, if you don't factor that in, then, you know, it's a different thing. But yeah, my hope is that, and I can see like what you're doing is not just about working with the people themselves in these situations, whether it's the family or the person who is facing death, but also just trying to raise awareness around this idea, this topic, and normalize it in the same way that we try to normalize a lot of things right now that have a stigma attached to them. And this is obviously the biggest one of all is let's get comfortable with this. Let's at least keep it in the room. And again, like, you know, just in reading your book, because I'm somebody who, you know, I do fear it. I don't understand it. I have, you know, fears and anxieties and concerns and confusions about it. But honestly, even just reading the experiences that you had with all of these different people, it started to make me, at the very least, it started to make me appreciate, you know, kind of pay more attention to like I went to a really hard class this morning and I was sweating and I was miserable. And then I was like, oh my God, but I get to do this. Like I get to be physically miserable for this moment. And I know that, you know, not everybody gets to have that next day. And that's the perspective, I guess. Sorry, that's my big rant, but.
It's a great one, but you're right. Absolutely. That perspective. But also one thing that I love, I was also on my Peloton this morning kicking my own ass. But when I was breathing heavy and hard and I was like, I was like, oh, right. My breath, what a gift this breath is,
yeah.
You know, and also the very temporary nature of it all. This is everything is impermanent, everything except for styrofoam, like everything dies at some point. It's temporary. It's very, yeah. very temporary.
It's very
for
temporary.
Better. And also for the more difficult, it's all yeah. temporary. Yeah.
Well, and I think that so many people need a constant reminder in order to keep things in perspective. Like when you have something that's right in front of you, you know, during the time that I spent researching your work and reading your book, I'm very much more present of, you know, how I want to be thinking and how I want to be conducting my life, you know, living for the moment and living for living. But then, you know, you close the book and you move on. And my hope is that some of that stays. But I think in many ways, the people that are doing the work that you do are probably actually the most joyful and appreciative of the moment, even though on its surface, you know, the title of Death Doula sounds very grim. I feel like it's probably the opposite. Is that true?
Absolutely. And let me tell you what, death doulas and folks working in the end-of-life space know how to party, okay? They are the funnest, wildest, most creative, hilarious people I've ever met.
Of course.
Well, because we're touching it all the time.
Yeah.
We're touching grief. We're touching loss. We're standing at the doorway of existence with folks all the time. When we get to walk back, it's like, holy cow, I am still here. I'm yeah. still here. When being in the presence of a body where life has just left, I cannot help but be so grateful that I still have mine.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be impossible. I don't see how you couldn't, you know. Yes, don't get me wrong. There's still plenty of sadness and it can feel really dense and hard and tricky sometimes.
Yeah.
And on the other side, there's so much life in dying. There's so much humor and there can be beauty and there can be joy. There can be laughter. There can be like brightness and lightness and levity of spirit. Sometimes yeah. death is also coming as a relief. Somebody has been sick for yeah. a while or somebody is choosing because they've either chosen medical aid and dying or they're done, they're ready to go. And for them, it's a celebration in some yeah. ways, you know. I also just want to note what a privilege it is in order to be able to think about mortality, to be able to think about my death. It says not only are all of my basic needs met, but also that I feel a sense of safety in my body and in my environment and in my community to be able to think about my death in a way that's like, oh, that could be nice because there right. are people all over the place that are dying in a lot of horrific, horrific ways that don't have the privilege of saying, what could I want my death to be like?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's so important. It really is. It really is a privilege to even be able to consider this as opposed to just not even be able to think about preparing for it or actually to prepare. It reminded me actually, well, on the other note, just in terms of the joy and the concept of kind of looking down the face of this, a friend of mine is, she's a nurse practitioner and she actually does a lot of death doula work. She works almost exclusively with psychedelics in, yes. Do you want to meet her? She's amazing.
Yes.
She's also quite a joyful person. But she uses psychedelics as a tool for the people that she's working with. I'm wondering if that's a part of your practice at all and how much experience you have there.
I still have my bar license. And psychedelics still remain illegal in the state of California. I think that psychedelic drugs are medicine. I think that they're really useful. As I wrote about in my book, I had an experience with psilocybin that finally helped me see what it was that I was struggling with and through. And for that, I will always be grateful. I have used psychedelics personally, and I find them to be really useful. I can also understand how in the end-of-life context, they are supportive for folks that are working through fears around death. Or are trying to create some context for what their life has meant to create mm-hmm. some meaning around it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can. I'm so curious. I'd love to just be a fly on the wall at some point in that experience. What is the so let's talk a bit about the process, right? And I want to know. I would like to know the process that is in play, both from both sides of the table. So when you're working with the family and when you're working with the person, and then I also want to know what's involved in the training of other doulas and what are the resources? And I mean, they're two very different questions, but I wanted to get them both out and you can decide which one you want to answer, if not both.
Let's start with what the training is like.
Yeah.
So not everybody who's a death doula has gotten some training. Realistically, most of us will serve as a doula at some point for somebody in our lives because we live in community and dying happens in community and somebody in the community is going to die. I wanted just to note real quick here how you said that nobody in your life has died yet. And you feel ill-equipped to deal with that at some point. We all kind of are, because every death is the first one. You know what I mean? And yes, it's coming at some point for all of us. Either it'll be you or somebody that you care about. So you'll get plenty of practice, Erica.
Yes, don't you worry. I know.
Yeah, don't you worry. So not everybody who's a doula got some formal training. You know, I was thrown into it like I was with my brother-in-law, but then decided to do something about it. This training program that I've created is for folks that want to be deeper in the practice. My hope is that everybody will take some doula training at some point, because these are life skills. Like, what were we doing at the Pythagorean theorem in high school or middle school? We really should have been learning about compassion and wrapping up affairs after somebody dies. That aside, doula training looks like building a personal relationship with death, as I mentioned before. We have several modules in the Going with Grace end of life training program built around our bringing our consciousness and our awareness to our own dying. We also think about the art of medicine and the signs of dying, what dying looks like in the body, so that we can identify those. Although we do non-medical care and support, it's important that doulas have some awareness about what dying actually looks like in the body. Mm-hmm. We also talk through natural death care, caring for bodies at home, preparing bodies for funerals. We discuss the funeral industry and home funerals, talking about legacy and ritual and meaning making. We spend some time on advanced planning and advanced directives. There's a module on wrapping up affairs after somebody dies, a big module on grief and bereavement and burnout, and then the last module on self-care and business building. Mm-hmm. This course is offered in an online format, but we also have it in a retreat setting where folks can come to us and dive in for 5 days. And let me tell you what, it is juicy.
Okay? Yeah,
I bet. Things that people come up with, right? To me, this is the biggest conversation we should all be having. In fact, it's the one that underwrites all the rest of it. So when folks dive into the conversation around death, a lot of things come up, and it's a great time for folks to be with their lives and also learn about how to support other people in their life and thus their death. Doula training it should also have components of justice and activism within it, because in order to support somebody to wrap up their lives, the totality of their lives, to me, to sit with them for whatever it is that their lives has been, is an absolutely radical act. And imbued in supporting people at the end of life is activism at its root. I have to be able to support everybody. I mean, I don't have to. I could choose to only to support people that look like me and talk like me and act like me. But first of all, how boring would that be? Mm-hmm. And next, I still don't know what it is that they need, because it's not me. It's not my experience.
Right.
And so it's important that we learn how to be with our privilege and our bias to be able to adequately support the other in their experience. Mm-hmm. Now, the second part of your question was about what the work actually entails. Mm-hmm. It looks so different. It looks different for every client.
Yeah.
As I was mentioning earlier, some of it is emotional. Sometimes folks just need to work through their relationships. There is a client story that I eventually cut from the book because it got too long, because I could have written for forever, about a client who was nearing the end of her life and realized that her kids didn't want to come and see her at the end. She'd been estranged from them for a little bit, and she was dying and felt that they should be there. And yet the kids are like, "Ma, we're good. Like, you were a shit mother. And we have made all of our peace with your dying, and go with God." And she had a really hard time with that, understandably. It was a difficult, dense situation. And so our work together was helping her come into some peace with that. Mm-hmm. We were able to eke out a letter that she wrote to her kids. And then she moved into active dying just a couple of days later. Sometimes it's spiritual, helping people get clear on their beliefs about the afterlife because there's some hesitation about heading into it. I mean, mm-hmm. none of us know what's going to happen. And we have all these set of beliefs, but beliefs remain beliefs until they're tested. And then they become, then we have evidence for them. And so they're just sitting on the precipice of finding out. And so that's tricky and dense. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we're helping people get clear on their affairs, make sure that everything is in order. We have passwords and accounts, and we know who's taking care of the dog and what they want done with their body and their services. And so it's a whole gamut of folks, of things. Just what are the needs? How can I support you?
And is there, what is the typical timeline, or is that just very different as well?
Very different. Sometimes it's years. There was a client I worked with for like 3 or 4 years because she had dementia and pneumonia, and they thought that she wasn't taking antibiotics. They thought that the pneumonia was going to end her life. And that's when I came on, and then she survived and she lived for years afterward. And sometimes it's one phone call nearing the very, very, very end of life. There was a client who had pancreatic cancer. He'd been sick for a while, but hadn't prepared anything because he thought he was going to get better. And if you know pancreatic cancer, it's a real insidious form. And he'd been sick for, I think, like 9 months or something of the sort. But he had 2 children and a home. The other parent for the kids was not available. He hadn't talked to the kids about his dying. There was no will in place. There had been no guardian discussion. He also, his affairs were all over the place. And it was just one intense phone call with him and his sister trying to get all the things on paper so that they could go and do it. But he didn't live long enough. It depends.
Yeah, it depends. I'm sure you've been asked this question before, and it's probably not a totally fair question, but since you are closer to it than most of the rest of us, because this is your work and this is what you experience on a regular basis, what do you think happens in that moment? What do you think? I'm not asking necessarily about the afterlife, but what is your sense of what that moment is of crossing over or just leaving?
It's tricky because dying doesn't happen in a single moment. I love this question, but when do we begin to die?
I mean, when we're born, I guess.
I guess, but what about those that are born dead?
Yeah.
They're not alive in the womb?
Right.
You know, when do we begin to die? When being around somebody who is actively dying, there are some observable changes that are occurring in the body. And at some point, breath stops and the body looks still. There could still be a faint heartbeat there. And also, even when the heart stops, the veins and arteries in the feet probably haven't got that notion yet. And so they're still working. The cells are probably still working on some level. And then eventually those die. I like to think that it happens in one big flash. Like, you're here, and then, like I wrote about in my book, boom, burst of confetti, and you're gone. Yet I think it's probably a gradual stepping away from all that we know and our sensory experience and the body experience. I think it might be a real trip.
Yeah, I mean, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it, but there certainly are times where, whether I'm meditating or maybe falling asleep, and I'm vaguely aware that, you know, my consciousness has shifted somehow. And I think for a second, you know, like, is this what it feels like when you just let go a little bit more and a little bit more of your consciousness? And obviously it's nothing like meditating or sleeping. It's a completely different thing, but that's the closest parallel, and nobody knows the answer. And I guess the idea here is to become curious and open to finding out the answer as opposed to ignoring the question, because it can't actually be ignored.
Yeah. Stay curious. And staying curious about our experience with it as well, you know, paying attention to where there's fear or the desire to like curl up in a ball and pretend it's not happening, or the things that are like exciting or, you know, feel not so difficult for us, paying attention, staying curious about me in it. Because there's a lot to learn from our fear of death or our relationship to mortality, but we have to be willing to look at it that way. And to me, it's the most useful one, because all the rest, the things that make me want to run away, just because I avoid it or just because I don't want to think about it, doesn't mean it's not going to happen. It just means I'm going to be entirely ill-prepared. Like my death is going to come as a stranger.
Yeah.
And I don't want that.
Yeah. No, that language is, that resonates. You don't want it to be a stranger. So what do you, we talked a little bit before about how it's part of the module, but what does your self-care look like in order to make sure that to the best degree you can, you leave your work at work and you still are able to show up for yourself and for your clients and for your loved ones? Like, what is your routine or what does your self-care look like?
It's tough. It's tough to remember, because as we were talking about at the beginning, you know, I come from a place of giving often, which means that what I need and what I want is pushed to the back. In fact, I did just talk to my therapist yesterday, which she just surgically said, we need to get to the place where you matter as much as your mission.
Whoa, and I said, shit.
Right?
Damn.
Oh, God, dog. She is surgical. Okay. Yeah, I'm still hanging on to that. I haven't even really touched it to process it. I was just like, okay, got it, lady.
Okay.
Moving on. Yeah, I got to go. So lately, I've been giving myself a lot of space just to have all types of feelings about my work and what's happening. It's been a really busy time as I'm preparing for this book coming out. Mm-hmm. I am not seeing clients currently. I couldn't hold it. But so much of the work also happens in the conversation around death that I'm having all the time. When I was seeing clients, often it's going to sound really benign, but I would eat a lot of potato chips. The salt, the crunch, the fat, the chewing of it. I don't know what it is. The kettle chips in particular.
I love kettle they just, chips.
Me too. They really soothe me in a way.
Yeah.
I think it grounds me back in my body. It helps me remember that I have edges and boundaries, that this is my experience that I'm having, you know? There's a number of practices also I picked up along the way. Like when I'm going into a home where I know dying is occurring, I will touch the jamb of the door as I cross the threshold to remind myself that I'm going in and I will also come out. You know, the dying that's occurring there. Obviously, I'll be changed by it, but that is their experience. And mine is what I'll take with me. I take baths or try to wash my body in some way when I get home.
Yeah.
Often in the bath, I'll sit and then sit in the bath also as all the water drains down to remember that it's taking those things that aren't mine. But really, the biggest one has been my boundaries and learning to be with my shadow and learning to be with the parts of me that give to feel worthy and to feel loved, remembering what is mine to keep and what is not, because a lot of the grief is not mine to keep. Maybe I can hold it briefly. Maybe I can carry it alongside with them, but I gave it back at some point and I have my own. So it's a lot of constant work.
Yeah, no, I mean, it must be incredibly depleting, even as it's filling you up in some ways. It is energetically, it has to be depleting, because to some degree, you do have to be a little bit stronger than everyone else in the room. And if you're having a day where you're not necessarily feeling so strong, or for reasons having nothing to do with the people in that room, well, I mean, what are you doing in that moment?
Yeah, either I'm calling for support, like another doula who can support me, or also getting over myself really quickly, really, really fast. Get it together, girl. So you can't find your sock, you'll deal.
Yeah, maybe some potato chips will help with that.
Potato chips.
I really like that. I think that the potato chip thing is interesting. It's kind of an ASMR thing, right? It's very tactile. You can hear it. You can feel it. You feel it in every part of your mouth. And it's very, it sort of brings you, like you said, it grounds you, it brings you present. It's like a very dynamic eating experience as opposed to something soft like pudding or whatever.
Or soup. You know, crunch, crunch, crunch. Really spectacular.
It changes the molecules a little bit more. That's interesting. But speaking of speaking of eating, you did have some very wise wisdom about the cake that I loved, that I would hope that you would share a little bit more of your thoughts on cake.
I love cake. I think cake is really a gift unto mankind, humankind. I have been with far too many clients who dieted a lot throughout their lives or were restrictive about food in some way and are now like dying to eat something that they really would enjoy because they have lost sensation on the taste buds, either as a result of chemo or just the desire for food is entirely gone, which is just a part of the normal dying process, and didn't have enough of the things that they really loved when they were living. Mm. There was one client that I talk about in the book, but also my TED Talk, who wanted some passion fruit souffle. It was her absolute favorite. And she didn't eat it most of the time while she was living and nearing her dying. I just put a little bit on her lip. Then she would lick it. And when she couldn't do that anymore, she would just smell it. And so I want to remind folks as much as possible that this body that you've got has desires. You know, it has desires. Food is not our enemy. Yeah. It's not our enemy. There is a brief amount of time that we have to eat the things that are delicious. And so eat them. Like, eat them in moderation. Obviously, throw some kale in there every once in a while, too. But enjoy your cake. Enjoy your cake. Enjoy your brownies. Enjoy, like, all the Nutella. My boo just bought a big jar of Nutella today. I said, thank God for him. God, he brings me chocolate cake all the time. This is love, okay? Do you hear me?
That is love. I love
it. Yeah.
Eat the cake.
Eat the cake.
For me, it's cheese more than cake, but yeah.
Yum.
Just cheese all the time. Just cheese. I'll eat the cheese. I have a cheese date this afternoon, actually. So I really just encourage everybody to read this book. It's so powerful and it's so universal. It's not about if you have somebody in your life that is facing death or you yourself are. Obviously, it's very relevant there, but I think it's equally meaningful and powerful for those of us who are still in this place of like, well, not yet, because it's coming, like you said. Do you have any other wishes or tips or things that we can all do today that might be in line with thinking about approaching death a little bit more gently? Eating the cake is definitely one of them.
Yeah, eating cake. There's a million things, obviously. I mean, one of the things about my book is it's a memoir. So I talk about my own life when I was not thinking about my mortality and then what opened up when I started to. My invitation, my hope is that folks that read the book and engage with it will take the invitation into their own lives to like fill it out to its edges right now. And so I hope that we all spend a little bit of time thinking about the things that make us feel really alive, you know, either through the places, the activities that you do that make you lose track of time are the ones that make you feel like your best self, or being around people that make you feel like the fucking fantastic human that you are, and surrounding yourself with that reflection, going outside, feeling like sun on your skin, if it's something that's available to you, or just trying to do our best to like ground into the experience of living for as brief as we can. This life is so fleeting. It's so fleeting. And so bringing our attention into the present in any way is useful. Also trying to bring your attention into your body, this sack of flesh and tissue and blood and bone, and how it's aging and its ride and its gratitude for all it does for you and for us while we're living. Those are ways that I think we can start, tiny ways that we can bring our mortality into the present, because the present is all that we've got.
That's why they call it the present.
It's a gift.
It's a gift.
Ding, ding, ding.
Oh, Elua, it's been so, so wonderful to meet you and hear this from you directly. And I'm so just thrilled for you and inspired, and you're truly doing absolutely incredible work. And congratulations and the best of luck to you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Erica.
Thanks for listening to All Too Well, guys. And as always, I am accepting stars, reviews, all of the above. They don't cost you anything and they mean a lot to me. So if you do have time, head on over to Apple Podcasts and throw me a few stars and, just do a good turn. Thanks.